Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Hallett. In this week's show, I'll speak with actor Ned Beatty. The Louisville native's most recent film release is showing at the Baxter Avenue Theaters.
The toughest guy in the world is playing the bad guy who has a good heart.
Right.
And, it's a little hard for me to talk about this movie because I love it so much.
Also, WFPL Stephanie Sanders continues her series of interviews with the members of Louisville's Metro Council.
And I think a president is really kind of the same. If you're doing your job and promoting things in a proper manner, I think people probably don't notice you're there so much.
And WFPL's Robin Fisher explores the literary side of Louisville with a writer, publisher, and bookstore owner.
In terms of a city our size, I think certainly we're on their mental map, their sort of literary radar as a place that they can send an author to and there'll be a lot of interest.
Now the news. Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, WFPL's Stephanie Sanders continues her discussions with each of the members of Louisville's Metro Council. We'll hear from three more council members this week. First, though, Ned Beatty was once dubbed the busiest actor in Hollywood, and as he approaches age 70, the Louisville native still has plenty of work to keep him occupied. Beatty, who grew up in the St. Matthews area, was in the fourth decade of a prolific movie, television, and stage career. He earned an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor for the 1976 film Network. His breakthrough movie role came earlier in 1972 when he played Bobby Tripp in Deliverance, alongside Burt Reynolds, John Voight, and Ronnie Cox. Most recently, Beatty's been promoting the independent film Sweetland, which was released theatrically late last year and just last month made its way to a Louisville screen. Beatty has a supporting role in the film, which stars John Hurd and Alan Cumming. Ned Beatty spoke to us recently from his home in Central California. Well, let's talk about Sweetland. How did you get involved in this project?
I got involved with Sweetland because I married a lady of Norwegian heritage and had that got around, and I got a phone call and said, would I be interested in making a movie in Minnesota, which where we live in the summertime is her hometown is Carlstead, Minnesota. And they said, would you be interested in making a movie in Minnesota that concerns Norwegian immigrants? And I thought it was a joke. I mean, I just sort of let it lay there for a minute, and I said, duh. I'm not interested. I'm married, too. So that was an easy choice. I got the script. I love the script. And the whole thing has been, the whole experience has been one of great joy. I'm really proud to be in this film, and it's just there's some wonderful work. It's just unbelievable.
And this takes place during or around the time of World War One, correct?
Post World War One. Part of the story is the fact that one of the immigrants that comes, she comes from Norway because she's been taken to Norway by her father, who is a professor during the First World War, to get out of the danger and. Later on, she comes as a bride to a Norwegian farmer, but she is a fairly quiet girl, and she had never learned a lot of Norwegian, so she had to deal with the fact that she was a German, where people were still feeling negative feelings towards Germans.
And tell us about your character.
My character owned everything. He was the businessman, and I got to do wonderful things like foreclose on my cousin's farm, things of that nature. My character is not one of the most—he's the least pleasant of the people in the film, but he kind of goes to show how that part of the situation works, even in farmland. That it's very much about mortgages and banking and loans and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it was.
I watched it the other night, and the guy is really despicable. Mm. He's a real piece of work.
Truly, truly. And our only answer, the character actor's answer to that is somebody's got to play it, you know.
That's right. Do you like playing those types of roles?
I think most people who get to play those kind of roles will tell you that they'd much rather be the villain than anything else. I mean, it's sort of nice to play the beloved grandfather or the uncle who's great to everybody and, you know. all those things are fun, but the guy who is mean.
I watched a DVD of it the other night, but I really like to see it on the big screen. The cinematography is great.
Yeah, it kind of wants that. As a matter of fact, went through this whole thing once we'd gotten it done and it was put together and we got to see it one time. I said, you know, I'm going to be in trouble. You're going to have to let me find some way to show this to my neighbors up in Carlston, because Sandy, my wife, and I, we keep telling people about this movie, and it's about them, it's about their ancestors, and we want them to see it, and we had no way of doing it. I said, couldn't you give me a DVD? And he got this look on his face like, you want people to watch my movie on a television screen?
It really begs for the big screen.
Yeah, it does.
A great cast, too. I really enjoyed, of course, your performance, but also Alan Cumming and John Hurd were great as well.
Yeah, John Hurd was so good. And John Hurd was the grump. I got such a kick out of it. I never met John before this film. And he was being the grumpy guy during that period of his life. He did such a wonderful job. It just makes my heart sing, you know, and my eyes cloud up, because that was not an easy part to play. That was another guy who was the toughest guy in the world is playing the bad guy who has a good heart. You
right.
know? And it's a little hard for me to talk about this movie because I love it so much.
And the young woman, you know, the young German woman was terrific as well.
Yeah, Elizabeth Reiser. She was working so hard. I got to tell you, she got that part, and 2 weeks later they started shooting. She knew nothing about German. She knew nothing about Norwegian. She had phonetic writings of all these things she had to say. I mean, she just, can you imagine what a workload that was? Just learning the lines. And she just did amazing. My favorite scene in the movie is where they finally get into an argument. And he's speaking Norwegian, she's speaking German, and there are no what do you call the little words at the bottom of the page?
The subtitles.
Subtitles. Mm-hmm. There's no subtitles, but you know exactly.
Yeah, I noticed that.
that's literally my favorite scene in the film. And Tim Kenny, I can't. Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, Tim's fun because Tim is one of those jokesters of all times. He loves a practical joke, and. But he did such a good job in this movie. He learned how to drive that team. I mean, this short period of time, everything that was done on this movie with the camera turning was done within 24 days.
Wow.
And the only way that's possible is that the first-time director, which we hear about a lot of times, first-time directors, this first-time director had made about 250 big-time commercials. Mm. And his knowledge of how it works, how filming works, how it all goes together, everything was incredible. And I'm so proud of him, because this was something he needed to do, and he did it. And boy, as far as I'm concerned, he got it right.
And this film has quite a Louisville connection. You're from here, of course, and
right.
I understand one of the producers is as well.
Mm-hmm. Gil Holland. Now, I don't see Gil often enough. I know that he and his wife have had a baby, and I'm not sure. I don't. They might be living in Louisville.
I think they are. I'm not sure, but I believe they are.
He's a wonderful fella. I will tell you, he's a bit sneaky. If he wants you to be in a film, he'll figure out a way that it's going to happen, and you might as well just get over it. Get over it and show up. No, I love Gil. My wife is actually, Gil got us a trip to Norway. He got my wife and I a trip to Norway. We stayed a week over at past the Norwegian Film Festival because we were all involved in a film called Spring Forward. Tom Gilroy's film was shown there. And we stayed a week and went and visited the ancestral lands and the farm that her family had come from. Met some relatives, and it was wonderful. But after I put the movie, shot the video, and I never edited anything, I had more fun editing this thing. And I made her say, every time we came to a new city spot, I made her say, Willkommen to Norge. So she said this about 20 times on video. And finally, I said, could you do it again? She said, Verstuden, which means, don't you understand? Anyway, I set her down to an interview with her about being in Norway, and she said things about Gil Holland he probably should never hear.
Now, does she go with you on the Sweetland shoot?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That was fun. That was a sweet little town. The name of the town is the name of the town is Montevideo. But being Minnesotans, they call it Montevideo.
Right.
And being Minnesotans further, they call it Monty. and being Minnesotans, by the time the film crew lived there, it was being called M.
Now, do you get back to Louisville much?
Not as much as I'd like. You know, after my mom kind of came to California to be with us, and then when she passed away, I came home, you know, because she wanted to be buried there. And I don't have too much close family around anymore. I've got a cousin I'm close to, but he and his wife spend a lot of time in Florida. So
I see.
But no, I don't get there very often. As a matter of fact, I was trying to get there this year, but the schedule never kind of cleared up, so I can't do it.
Now, you had a pretty pretty big golf event every year for a while, didn't you?
Yes, that lasted for a while. And as a matter of fact, it's being brought back in sort of a gentle way, I'm glad to hear, because golf tournaments have a tendency to get out of hand.
Yeah.
And the one that we had started, it's kind of strange because I was involved in it almost from the beginning. We used to have a PGA tournament called the Derby Open, and I caddied in it one year. I caddied for Jack Fleck, and we were right up among the leaders after 3 days, and then my golfer sort of went funny. Maybe it was the caddy that went funny. I don't know. people love the tournament, and it only had lasted a few years, and people really. So they decided when they started to do a charity tournament that they had to have professionals there to play. So when you would do a team of people playing in this tournament, you'd have to have one professional with them. Well, that got more and more expensive every year because players got more and more money just for showing up for an event like that.
Right.
And it got to the point where we were sort of putting on the amount of money that was going to the charity was not sufficient, let's put it that way. So they're trying to bring it back on a small scale, and I hope it works.
Do you have any interest in horse racing?
You know, John Houston asked me, he was getting ready to do a film called The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, and I was having a meeting with him. Was he going to cast me to play sort of Judge Roy Bean's sidekick and bartender? And he asked me if I was from Kentucky, that I was a horseman. He said, I like working with them. I like feeding them. I like leading them around. But I don't care much about getting up on their back because I take one look and I think, if I wouldn't let you ride me. I mean, are you kidding? So that was the wrong thing to tell John Houston, because then he proceeded to make me want to be a horseman.
Well, what are you working on these days?
Well, a little reshoot on a film that I have really high hopes for called Charlie Wilson's War. It's about our involvement in Afghanistan when the Russians were there. And I play a senator in this one, too. I play a congressman. And Tom Hanks plays a congressman who is junior to my congressman, and I'm this committee chairman on the committee he's on. And I have high, I think a lot of Tom Hanks, and I really think this is going to be a good one for him. It's about a kind of a quasi-goofy congressman, which I think we have a few of.
I've heard good things about that book. I haven't read it, but I've heard a lot about it.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. He's as tall as a Texan should be. And I couldn't believe it. I met him before I knew he was the writer of the book that we were doing the film from. And he's a piece of work. No, but that one, and then another film called The Electric Mist, which is being done in New Iberia, Louisiana, and which Tommy Lee Jones is starring in.
So you're staying busy.
More or less, yeah. I keep retiring.
You do.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that nobody, you know, it's like, what do you have to tell people? I've tried crutches, you know, put my arm a sling. No, it is fun. You know, the funny thing about it, I think the reason actors don't like retire is the process is, there's something awfully fun about it.
Yeah.
And I think it's the fact because it's a creative thing you do with other people. Now, there's something about that which I think it's why we all come off looking like, you know, New Age communist or socialist or something. There's something about the fact that we can do this thing together.
Yeah.
And it's just...
I guess you really forge a lot of friendships, you know, with the, not only with the other actors, but with the crew and everybody involved
on the
film.
And what's weird about it is that there's an understanding, not only you have this closeness when you're working, but there's this understanding that it's going to end and you're going to go off in different directions. You may not see each other for 10 years. You might go to a charity affair and it'll be like, how wonderful. You know, here I saw so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why people show up at those things, quite frankly.
Just to renew old friendships.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing that you can get to see people again. Because I think all of us have this funny feeling is that if you do a lot of kind of socializing with the people you work with, it gets to be the feeling that you're just looking for a job.
Yeah.
And I guess that doesn't stand up to the fact of how close and how well you feel about each other.
Well, Ned, we thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Louisville native Ned Beatty can be seen in the independent film Sweetland, which is currently showing at the Baxter Avenue Theaters in Louisville. Sweetland will be released on DVD in July. When we come back, we'll hear from three members of the Louisville Metro Council in our continuing series of discussions with each of its 26 members. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up a little later in the show, WFPL's Robin Fisher talks Louisville literature with three people who live it every day, a writer, a publisher, and a bookstore owner. First, we continue our series with the members of Louisville's Metro Council. Over the last several weeks, we brought you three discussions between members and WFPL's Stephanie Sanders. This week, we'll continue with Districts 10, 11, and 12. District 10 Councilman Jim King has served on the council since 2003 and shared his thoughts on its effectiveness.
How do you feel about the council specifically? Is it working as effectively as it can?
Well, I've equated it a lot of times to being on a church committee. You get a church committee of 11 people and you get 11 different opinions. But in essence, it ultimately works. And I think that although 26 members is very cumbersome, it probably is the most effective way to get us very close to our constituents. I think that in the last 2 years since I've been on the council, I've seen us shift from being highly partisan to to less partisan, and I think that there's less turf wars going on and more of a sense of collegiality and collaboration.
I've heard that from a few members saying that it's gotten better. What do you think is the reason for that?
Well, I think that as you have people gain experience, they have a little less fear about the unknown. They get to know each other better. I think that they're more willing to share information because they build a level of trust. I hope that I've had some, you know, small part in that as caucus chair and majority leader for the last year. I made an extra effort to have an open process during budget last year between the Republicans and Democrats, and I hope that that contributed to the sense of trust, and I think that that's helped.
Do you feel like people in your district understand that they have a person they can contact if they have a city need?
Oh, there's no question that's the way I feel. You know, one of the slogan I used when I ran for office was connected to you, which meant connected to our constituents. And the thought process there was that our constituents, our neighbors, would have access to downtown, to City Hall through me, and I would be the go-to guy for them. My sense is that they feel very comfortable with that. I have a legislative aide, Rob Holtzman, who makes a point to return phone calls and to return emails and to get action very, very quickly. And I get very, very good feedback on that, lots of thank yous and lots of notes of appreciation. And my sense is that, you know, our constituents feel like they're getting the services they deserve.
Do you feel that is your primary role as a councilman, or do you feel more that it's being a legislator or a balance?
It's a great question because I'm trying to mature as a councilman, as a legislator. And again, having only been on the council 2 years, I have still a lot to learn. And, you know, to some extent, you know, my approach to this has been somewhat parochial. And that is that I have felt like I should represent my constituents jealously and really guard the neighborhoods. That has led me in some instances to run up against what are more citywide needs, and I have to make a decision as to whether or not I support the citywide needs or I support the needs of my district. And it's something that's just an evolving process that I'm trying to learn.
District 11 Metro Councilman Kevin Kramer has been on the council since 2003 and was elected president of the body in 2006. Kramer spoke about how the council continues to grow.
You feel that merger is working and continuing to develop?
I think it is. I think it is. There are, of course, opportunities to continue to improve. There are some areas that we've merged that we need to continue to focus on and to try to expand. Again, I'd point out folks are paying. There's still an urban service district tax, and there are still differences in the level of garbage collection and areas like that. And so I think we need to continue to look at creative ways to help people recognize and understand this as one city instead of an urban service district in a Metro Louisville. But by and large, I think we've seen a tremendous improvement.
As you go through that process, there's a whole other process with kind of the evolving relationships between the people who are on the council. Do you think that when it comes to maybe some of the larger issues that the council has dealt with, that the council is polarized?
Gosh, that's... I hope not. Let me say that. I hope not. When we first started this grand experiment, if you will, in merged government, unlike the previous structure, you are elected from your district by party. And so we actually have two different parties represented in local government, which at least at the city level hasn't been true for quite some time. And at the county level, there had only been some marginal amount of partisan politics. And so initially I think there was a great deal of discomfort, a bit of lack of trust. And then with the caucuses being set up, and there was a lot of question about, the motivations for that. I think through the first couple of years, we worked through some of that. And I think we had gotten to a point where I don't think that was quite the issue. And I felt pretty good about the way things were going. Felt pretty good about last year and the less than partisan discussion and debate. But like so many things, we don't exist in a vacuum. National politics has changed things considerably. It's caused a lot of attention and created lots of discussion. And I remain hopeful that we can continue to run the city and build relationships and talk about what's in the best interest of the city and not get bogged down in, which party. There's a presidential election coming, and the Congress just changed hands. So I don't know. It remains to be seen if we can hopefully avoid those pitfalls.
Rick Blackwell represents District 12 and is serving this year as president of the Metro Council. He spoke with Stephanie Sanders about the role and how he hopes to guide the council.
Why did you want to take on the president's position in Metro Council?
I felt kind of called to do that, I think. I felt like I did a nice job of working in a bipartisan spirit with the budget last year. We set out as our goal to try to have an open process and have everyone involved and really to try to get a 26-0 vote. We were one vote short of that, but we had 25-1 vote on the budget, and I think people felt like we really moved things forward. There weren't winners and losers, but we moved things forward in a bipartisan fashion, and I felt like I could take that kind of perspective onto the council president as well.
How much work is that to make sure something can get passed with bipartisan support?
How much work is it to make sure that we get the bipartisan support? Is that what you're saying? It depends on the issue. Sometimes it's an awful lot of work to try to make it where it's something that people can all kind of agree to. We ran into some of those issues, with the arena. We ran into some of those issues that, with the, say, the dog ordinance, we kind of split on some party lines. So, there are some places where it becomes very, very difficult to do that. But then others, like the budget, it's really, it's a lot, there's still a lot of effort, but I guess there's more leeway there to give people's input and to have their input actually appear in the document. When you're talking about a huge budget, you can hear from people and they can feel like, well, maybe I didn't get that piece, but I did get this other piece over here that I think is important. When you're looking at specific issues like the dog ordinance or something like that, it's more difficult to do that. There's just not as much leeway, and there's a lot of competing. The districts have competing needs when it comes to those. So.
Do you see that as your most important function as president?
I do. Yes, I do. I think being a good president is an awful lot like people talk about a good referee in a ball game. That if you have a really good referee in a ball game, you don't know they're there. And I think a president is really kind of the same. If you're doing your job and promoting things in a proper manner, I think people probably don't notice you're there so much.
Do you think Louisvillians have an accurate view of Metro Council and how it works and who the people are who are involved?
Probably not. When I hear some of the concerns and some of the complaints maybe that get surfaced in the media, it seems to me that they don't have maybe a full understanding of what all that we do. And I think it's probably because, those issues that are big issues where people have a lot of differences on the issue, you know, those make the media more often. There people can side one way or the other with them, and you forget really and probably don't report too much on those other 95% of things that we have worked to a point where we all agreed with them, or pretty much all of us agree on those things.
The full versions of these interviews, as well as previous interviews in the series, are available at our website. We hope you'll join us at WFPL.org. We will continue our series tomorrow morning at 7:35 on WFPL with District 13 Councilwoman Vicki Welch. When we come back, we'll learn about the inner workings of Louisville's literary scene with WFPL's Robin Fisher. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. You've probably heard about book signings around town or read a review of a local author's book. But did you ever stop to think about why there are so many book-related events in Louisville? Have you been to any of the jazz and the spoken word readings or book signings? WFPL's Robin Fisher takes a look at literary Louisville from three different perspectives, with writer Diane April, Sarah Band Books' Nicole Brown, and Michael Boggs of Carmichael's Bookstore.
I kind of wanted to just sort of start with the general question. We're here to talk about literary Louisville, but you know, what does that mean? And sort of, I'd like to know what it means for each of you. And Diane, as a writer, what does that mean?
Well, I think that Louisville has a long and rich tradition of literature, and some wonderful writers have come out of Louisville. And I think also there's a great audience for literary events and the literary arts. And so as somebody who was born here and grew up here, went to school here, and now tries from time to time to have events that will pull in people to listen to writers read, I've just found that there's a terrific group of people out there who are very interested in reading and hearing the written word read. And that's really so important, and I think sometimes gets overlooked when you're looking at the general arts scene here. You look at dance, which is great here. You look at opera. You look at the glass-making efforts that are going on in town. All of these are great, but I think our literary arts sometimes are not looked at as seriously and carefully as they should be, because they're a huge part of what goes on here.
And Michael, as an independent book store owner, how do you fit into the picture?
Well, I think for me, it's my livelihood. So for us to have a vibrant literary scene means I can pay my mortgage and send my child to college and things like that. But it also, I chose to be in the book business because it was an interesting life. And I think if you're going to have to spend 8 hours of your day working at something, you're going to be lucky to do something that's very interesting. So the more varied the local scene is, the more support we get from customers and from people who are interested in literature, the happier I am, the more interesting my life is, the better we can make the bookstore. And then as a believer in books in general and reading as a positive force in the culture, anything that makes the scene more alive and healthier, I think is good for me, but it's also good for the culture at large.
Nicole, you sort of come at it from two different perspectives. You are a writer in your own right, a poet, and then you also work for Sarabande Press. What difference does it make to a community and to a community of writers to have a local press or local presses here?
Well, I think, as a writer, having a sense of community, you know, having that writing group, having readings that you can attend, and just the general energy that happens when you have all these things in place is really important to the isolation that one often experiences as a writer. But, you know, as a publisher, Sarabande is an independent press or a nonprofit press, and a large part of our mission is educational. And so we really like to reach out into the community in terms of literacy efforts, in terms of getting people interested in writing. We're actually a national press, but we do like to keep a lot of our initiatives local. And a lot of our donors and whatnot come from Kentucky, of course, and that's just really important to the health of our organization as well.
Tell us a little bit about the books that type of books that Sarabande publishes, because when you said education is part of your mission, mm-hmm. I don't want listeners to get the impression that you publish educational books.
Right. We publish about 10 to 12 books a year, and that book is just about the list is split just about in half between poetry titles and creative nonfiction and fiction titles. And of course, our list varies a lot. We have authors from all over. We also have a Kentucky series in literature that publishes one book by a Kentucky author every year, and that's been going on for some time now. The educational part is just to get people interested in literature in general. We had an initiative for National Poetry Month called Chalk It Up, where if you took a piece of chalk and wrote two lines of poetry, any two lines of poetry on the sidewalk, you know, we would send that person a free book. And that's really important to us.
And how is the energy level here in Louisville for writers, Diane? Louisville is a friendly city. We are friendly. Mm-hmm. I don't know how nurturing we are to our writers. And does that matter? I mean, sometimes do writers need the mean streets as opposed to, mm-hmm. you know, we're not quite south. Mm-hmm. Southern enough to be gothic, but mm-hmm. we're not northern enough to...
Right. Well, I think there's a lot of nurturance that goes out to writers here. Talking about education, I am also a teacher on the faculty of the Master of Fine Arts and Writing program at Spalding, and we're drawing in students, people who want to write from all over the country, as well as faculty members from all over the country all through the year, which has created more writing teachers and has done what Nicole was talking about, helping to nurture some of the writing groups where people get together and show each other their work and get critiqued back and forth. But also at the Jazz Factory, I've had this series going for 3 years now, a monthly series of called Jazz and the Spoken Word, which has surprised me in two ways. One is that I've been able to sustain it, getting good writers, a lot of different writers, some from out of town, mostly, 99% from Louisville or in the immediate area around here. But also filling the place up, with people who want to hear prose and poetry, and sometimes we have dramatic presentations read aloud. And so I think that's nurturing, too, because part of the writing process, as Nicole said, is very isolating. And if you can read work in progress or read something that you've just finished or just published, it's very rewarding and satisfying and encouraging to get an immediate response that way.
Michael, do you find, as a bookseller, do you find that the national presses will come here? I mean, do you find that they think we're too small, that Louisville doesn't have, does Louisville have the image we're in Kentucky and people don't read?
Well, anytime you get away from New York, you're going to have sort of the cliche of people don't, in New York, don't know what geography is. And so sometimes you'll say, oh, we're in Louisville, and they'll say, oh, where is that? And you'll say, well, you know, it's where it is. And they'll say, oh, it's a twin city with Nashville? No, not exactly. But my wife Carol does a lot of events, and we've worked really hard on sort of keeping our name in their face for authors. And so we do a lot of local authors, but we also try to do some, you know, national authors. And the reception has been pretty good. I think they know that we're here, and they know that Louisville's a pretty good literary town, and they can look at the turnout that we get for an event and compare it to St. Louis, Indianapolis, Cincinnati, and at least we hold our own there. It may not be the turnout that they would get in Chicago and Los Angeles, but it can't be expected. But in terms of a city our size, I think certainly we're on their mental map, their sort of literary radar, as a place that they can send an author to, and there'll be a lot of interest.
Well, it had to have helped when that study came out. Was it last year or the year before? Louisville was ranked actually as one of the most literate cities in the Midwest. Right. So if they pay attention.
Yeah, I definitely think, again, when you compare us to people like us, Cincinnati, St. Louis, mm-hmm. Indianapolis, we certainly shine in that environment. And you really can't ask us to be New York City or Chicago, but I think for us to hold our own against people our size and our location, I think is really a positive thing.
As an independent local bookseller, you have to walk a fine line. You want to bring in the books that people want to buy, which are oftentimes the best sellers, but you also want to support your local presses and your local writers. And you know, how is that balance? Is it sometimes it's tough? You want to.
Well, we've been in business for almost 30 years, and I think really from day one we were committed to trying to support local people as much as we could. And that means almost anybody who's got a book will give their book a chance, will put it in the store. Now, you know, sometimes they don't sell, they don't have a market, but and I think one of the really interesting things about Louisville is how much support there is across the kind of writing literary community. When we have events with a local author, you look in the audience and you'll see some faces, and one of them will be someone who's going to be have an event next week. And that person will have their event, and the person that was the author last week will be in the audience. And it's kind of a support community, and it's a kind of synergy that I think is, you know, is really great. And from a economic point of view, they buy the books. And so, you know, it allows us to carry as much as we possibly can locally, and we do, and those books are successful. Some are more successful than others, but so everything is.
I was going to say, such is life.
Right.
Nicole, how do you go about getting your book in front of a bookseller?
Well, you know, as far as through Sarah Band,
mm-hmm.
Well, we have a distributor consortium, so I travel quite a bit to New York to present those books to the sales reps. And people are often surprised that we're from Kentucky, or they just naturally assume that we're in Louisville, and I'm always kind of proud to tell them where we are. So our sales reps represent us quite a bit. But then I also do a lot of work in terms of trying to get reviews, radio interviews, things like that. And when we have time, we certainly try to host events at Carmichael's and the Jazz Factory and local places like that to let people know that we are here, and we try to bring in our authors as much as we can.
Well, Diane, how diverse is the writers' community here?
I think it's quite diverse. It's growing in its diversity. Let me put it that way. One thing we try
to
do.
As the city is.
Yeah. Whenever we have our monthly series, which is on a Wednesday, a different Wednesday almost every month. But that's one of the things I try to do, is make sure that there is a mix, both in terms of genres and perhaps topics, but also in terms of who the readers are, so that we get the voices of the community and not just the voices of the same people over and over again. And for example, the event that we're going to be doing for our next Jazz and the Spoken Word will be a celebration of the Bachelor of Fine Arts program in writing that is just beginning at Spalding. And we have a really wide array of readers, including kind of picking up on something that Nicole introduced me to when we had the National Poetry Month event that Saraband had sponsored, and that was to let people read their favorite poem. So most of the readings will be people reading their own work, but we're having a couple of celebrity types to come in and who aren't really writers, but who have a very special piece that they want to read. And we'll be doing another event like that in August for Peace Education, a program in the schools, and that will be all celebrities reading things from literature about conflict. Mm-hmm. And how it's resolved. And so those really grew out of the idea that Nicole brought to me. And so in that sense, I think there's a lot going on, people trying to use the written word to awaken us to a whole gamut of issues.
It also goes beyond the stereotype of that we've all seen in movies or television with the, you know, the writer standing up there and he's droning on and on. And he's if you engage your audience and even engaging them by not having the person that they assume is going to read.
Right.
One
other thing that we do that is very different is that we always have two musicians playing behind our readers, usually an upright bass player and a saxophone and flute player. And that really, Nicole has read
it's
this
so
way.
It's so much fun because they improv with your piece as you read, and it just adds a new layer to it. It's fantastic.
It's sort of a new old idea.
Yeah.
Nicole, you have your first book of poetry coming out in September. It's called Sister.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you are a part of both the writing and the publishing world.
Yes.
And how does that feel?
Exhausting. And wonderful. They're wonderful at the same time. Yes.
I have one final question for, I'm just going to throw it out and ask you all, why should it matter to the community whether or not Louisville has a strong literary culture? I mean, why should it matter?
Go ahead.
I mean, one thing that popped into my mind is, I mean, when you think about the truly well-known writers that have come from Louisville, whether it's Hunter Thompson or Marsha Norman or whoever, you know, it's important to have, and they didn't stay here, but it's important to have a strong community to nurture those people out there whom you may not know, but will later really take their talent and say a lot and influence the world. And so just for that reason, I think it's really mm-hmm. important to have that going all the time, that kind of sustenance.
Well, and to have an identity, I think, to have a literary identity that spreads beyond the city. I mean, again, like Diane said, if you say to someone, and we go to book conventions and things and say, oh, Hunter Thompson's from Louisville, and people say, really? And you say, Sina Naslin, oh, yeah, she's from Louisville. Really? And you say, mm-hmm. well, Saraband Press, that's, you know, they're down the street from us. Oh, really? That's a really nice press.
And Carmichael's is there.
And people, you know, and people kind of say, whoa, Kentucky, you know. It's like, let's give them a second look, you know. And yeah. So I think it's important for us to nurture it so that the people outside of Kentucky or of Louisville have a respect and an interest in what's going on mm-hmm. here.
And respect is really key, yeah. you know, and it adds a layer of texture and depth, I think, to everyone's life. But having pride in where you are is really important.
All right. Thank you all very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Ta-da.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with writer Diane April, Saraband Books' Nicole Brown, and Michael Boggs of Carmichael's Bookstore about literary Louisville. The next Jazz and the Spoken Word event will be Wednesday evening at 7:30 at the Jazz Factory. It is free and open to the public. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. or you can reach us by phone at 0204-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.